This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today, an Al-Qaeda operative based in Afghanistan claimed credit for Monday's bombing of the Danish embassy in Islamabad, Pakistan. My guest, Ahmed Rashid, says Al-Qaeda has expanded around the world, and now there are full-blown Taliban insurgencies in Pakistan and Afghanistan. Rashid also says that the mistakes of the Bush administration have created a far bigger crisis in South and Central Asia than existed before 9/11. Those mistakes are the subject of his new book, Descent into Chaos, The United States and the Failure of Nation Building in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Central Asia. Rashid is a Pakistani journalist who has covered the region since the late 1970s. His bestseller, Taliban, was one of three books he wrote before 9/11 about the problems of failed states, the rise of Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, and the failure of U.S. policy in the region. Ahmed Rashid, welcome back to Fresh Air. Before we get to your book, Denmark's embassy in Pakistan was bombed this week. What message does that send?
Well, I think it's a very horrendous message. It's obviously a major escalation by the Pakistani Taliban and Al-Qaeda to show foreigners what they can do. We've had two attacks this year. This is the second on the diplomatic community in Islamabad. And despite the enormous security that there now exists around the diplomatic quarter, this embassy, was bombed. People were killed.
You write in your new book that compared to what's at stake in Afghanistan and Pakistan, Iraq may well turn out to be a mere sideshow. Why do you think there's even more at stake in Afghanistan and Pakistan than there is in Iraq?
Well, I think, Iraq, despite the horrors that have happened in that country, 2.5 million refugees, tens of thousands killed, Iraq is going to remain a problem for the Middle East. And any eventual settlement there is going to involve the Arab countries, Israel, and possibly the Americans. Iraq is not an international issue. We have not had terrorist attacks in Europe and America launched from Iraq. And that's where I think the crux of the issue is, that despite all the hype by the Bush administration about Iraq having nuclear weapons and Al-Qaeda and terrorism, Iraq as an international issue has been sort of fairly benign in the sense that it has not posed a threat to the international community the way that the administration envisaged when it launched the war in 2003. Afghanistan and Pakistan, on the other hand, now house all the major terrorist groups and their leaderships. Particularly, most of them are on the Pakistan side of the border, in the borderlands, the tribal areas, and the army now is pulling out of there. That's going to leave a free hand to many of these terrorist groups. And if we look at any terrorist attack since 2004 in Europe, in North Africa, in the Far East, there has been the hand of that one or two members of these groups have either been for training, or they've got explosives, or they've got money, or they've got some kind of support from either Al-Qaeda or the Taliban in these tribal areas. So this region remains a major global threat, in my opinion.
Your new book is in part a critique of what America did wrong in Afghanistan. You say that you were in support of the invasion of Afghanistan at the time, and that you argued it was a just war, not an imperialist intervention, because only intervention could save the Afghan people from the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. But then you came to think that the United States really mishandled things in Afghanistan. So let's talk about why. One of the issues you write about is that the routing of the Taliban left the warlords in Afghanistan in place and even more powerful than they were before. Why did the U.S. consider the warlords its allies and strengthen them?
Well, the reason for that simply was that the Americans, in 2002, immediately the war ended, were really not interested in rebuilding Afghanistan. And I kept hoping that, they're going to build the roads, they're going to give electricity, they're going to invest in agriculture, and nothing happens. And clearly, what emerges then is that because the preparations for Iraq were already underway in the spring of 2002, huge amounts of resources were taken out of Afghanistan, the surveillance satellites, special forces, the reluctance of Donald Rumsfeld to deploy troops there. All this happens, and to fill the vacuum, the power vacuum that there was in the countryside, the CIA had a budget of about $1 billion, and they were told to go and buy up the warlords. The warlords would now be the peacekeepers, as it were, in the provinces outside Kabul, and they would maintain the peace and at the same time help the American forces look for al-Qaeda. Now, the problem was that a lot of these warlords were also taking money from al-Qaeda. So they were quite happy to receive American money, and they were now empowered by the U.S. military. And once that policy ended around end of 2003, 2004, and the Americans stopped these stipends to the warlords and stopped enlisting their militias into helping U.S. forces, it was too late. The warlords then went straight into drugs trafficking, most of them, and became very, very rich businessmen, now not needing any U.S. money. And, of course, they're still very much there.
So when the U.S. started giving the warlords even more power than they had by putting them on the CIA payroll, what did they want the warlords to do?
Well, essentially, they didn't want the warlords to disrupt anything. They wanted the warlords to keep the peace in the countryside, make sure that the tribes under their control didn't fight each other, the ethnic groups didn't fight each other. And they really gave them a carte blanche. I mean, as long as they kept the peace and they helped gather intelligence about members of al-Qaeda who might have fled here and there. But what they, of course, having been empowered by the Americans, they really threw their weight around. They created enormous law and order problems in the provinces, because, of course, they gave the best jobs, they gave the best positions to their own family, to their own clan, ostracizing other families and other clans and tribes. And so many of these warlords became very partisan in what they did. They began to smuggle, they got involved in drugs, they got involved in, you know, all sorts of shady dealing, buying weapons, selling weapons, etc. And all this was cause for enormous disruption. And what happens, you know, later on in 2003, 2004, when the central government tries to get a grip of the provinces and tries to send out governors and police chiefs who will now govern these provinces on behalf of the central government, these governors are not able to do so because the warlords are so powerful and so important.
You know, I'm thinking of Iraq as I hear your description, because in Iraq, part of the recent approach during the surge has been to give money to militia leaders to pay them basically not to fight the U.S., but to join in the fight against al-Qaeda and other militants in Iraq. Do you think we're running the same risk in Iraq with the policy of basically paying warlords there that we ran into in Afghanistan?
I think partly you are, simply because there will come a time, as there came a time in Afghanistan, that these warlords had to be disarmed. Their militias, which numbered up to 8,000 to 10,000 men, had to be disarmed. The same thing is going to happen in Iraq. When the central government becomes stronger, it will not want warlord militias wandering around the countryside. They will want the central Iraqi army and police force to be the main source of security and stability in the country. They will want to disarm these warlords, and they're going to find it a very difficult problem. However, I will say there's one difference, and that is that these tribal chiefs, warlords, as you will, in Iraq, who are being armed by the Americans, really do hate al-Qaeda, because they have been, you know, shot and killed and murdered by al-Qaeda. The problem in Afghanistan was that many of these warlords were in bed with al-Qaeda. They had given al-Qaeda sanctuary before, or they'd taken money from them, or they were using al-Qaeda contacts to smuggle drugs into other countries. So in Iraq, you do have these militia leaders. They genuinely do hate al-Qaeda. And why some degree of stability has come about in Iraq is because these militia leaders have actually gone after al-Qaeda. That's not what happened in Afghanistan.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ahmed Rashid, a journalist from Pakistan who's the author of the bestseller Taliban. His new book is called Descent into Chaos: The United States and the Failure of Nation Building in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Central Asia. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Ahmed Rashid. He's a journalist from Pakistan who has covered that region extensively for decades. He's the author of the bestseller Taliban. His new book is called Descent into Chaos: The United States and the Failure of Nation Building in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Central Asia. You're very critical of how the United States handled Afghanistan after the bombing and its failure to really help Afghanistan rebuild itself. Do you think that the United States action or inaction contributed to how the borderlands between Afghanistan and Pakistan became headquarters for Islamic terrorist groups?
I think the lack of a U.S. policy for nearly 3 years in Afghanistan certainly contributed to this, because the Taliban were able to come back into Afghanistan and say, well, we told you that these Americans will do nothing. In fact, they've given you more terrorism. These warlords are back. And we at least had got rid of the warlords, which was true. And secondly, I think there was enormous optimism amongst all the extremists who had gathered along the Pakistan-Afghanistan border that the Americans were really not serious about Afghanistan. You know, there would be this holding operation, they would have a few troops there, and once we launch our counterinsurgency against the Americans, you know, the Americans will just pull out and disappear. And I think the third negative this had was on Pakistan. The Pakistan army also believed that we would still like to see the Taliban back in some shape or form in Kabul. They are, after all, our proxy force, they're loyal to Pakistan, they're anti-India, and these Americans don't seem very serious about Afghanistan.
Another thing you're critical of the United States for is this. You say that the CIA condemned the opium trade in Afghanistan, but allowed it to flourish. And subsequent to that, drug money has permeated local government in every province. How did the CIA allow the opium trade to flourish? Well, what could it have done that it didn't do?
What I mean there was, it was not just the CIA, it was basically, you know, the U.S. government, the military, the State Department and everyone. Nobody really had a policy towards the drugs issue. Now, basically, it was seen as a benign issue. We, the Americans, have not invested in agriculture, so I suppose we can't blame the farmers for growing opium because it's a lucrative crop, it's cheap to grow, it doesn't need much water, and eventually it'll disappear, not understanding that this crop was, first of all, to spread right across the country, was to grow enormously, was to feed the warlords, and then was to fund the resurgence of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. And the real debate has been, what I was arguing very early on was that, okay, I can understand that American troops do not want to be go into the fields and actually start chopping off the poppy flowers and eradicating poppy fields and antagonizing the local population and farmers. But the alternative was that the American forces should have interdicted drugs traffickers. They should have interdicted convoys of drugs. And I recount several instances in my book where, you know, American officers are telling me, well, we're sitting here in the middle of this desert outpost. And, you know, this morning I woke up and I saw 12 trucks passing and they were all full of opium and I couldn't do anything about them. Now, it would have been the easiest thing for these American troops just to walk outside and stop these trucks and burn the crop. Burn that opium which was in the trucks. But they weren't allowed to do even interdiction. And let me tell you, 7 years on, there is still no American policy on drugs control. And of course, why interdiction was so important was that the Afghans were not capable of doing it themselves. You needed the foreign troops. I mean, this should have been the major contribution of the foreign troops to at least raise the stakes for the drug traffickers and for the opium dealers. And that was never done.
How would you rate Hamid Karzai, the president of Afghanistan, and his performance in trying to hold the country together and get it back on its feet?
Well, I think, you know, the problem is that he's been unwilling to understand how state structures are built and the role that the president must play in building these state structures. And instead, what we've had is massive corruption. You know, the drugs economy is now by far the largest economy in the country. Now, I met him, you know, just a week ago in Kabul, and I had a very long talk with him about, in fact, the elections are coming up next year, and he told me certainly he was going to stand, you know. And I said, well, have you thought of an agenda for the next 18 months? He didn't really seem to have a very clear answer about that as to what his agenda will be.
So what message did you deliver last week?
Well, I really delivered the message saying that he's losing credibility fast, that he is not popular anymore. The international community is losing a lot of faith in him, and he'll have to do something to pull his socks up in the next 18 months if he wants to win the elections and if he wants to retain the credibility of the public and the international community. And I said that several times in several different ways. And I think, you know, I mean, he took it in a good way.
You write that the World Bank estimates that there are now 26 failed states in the world that could breed terrorism, as opposed to 17 such states back in 2003. Is Afghanistan considered one of those failed states?
No, I still don't consider it a failed state. It was a failed state, of course, in 2001. We should also highlight the progress and advancements that have been made. I mean, more than half the country's children are now in school for the first time in the history of the country. Health has dramatically improved. Women's health has dramatically improved because of health facilities. I mean, there's a whole level of progress in the social sector that has been extremely positive and really heartwarming to see. I mean, every time you go back, you see this. Businesses have started, etc. The real failing continues to be the infrastructure, because you can't refloat or rejig the economy until you have electricity and roads and water and the bare essentials. And, you know, Kabul today, even today, still has 5 or 6 hours of electricity every other night. Every other night. You have no electricity during the day whatsoever. So 7 years on, I mean, are you going to build a factory in Afghanistan without alternate night electricity? No, you're not. And we're just talking about Kabul. We're not even talking about, you know, other parts of the country. And of course, infrastructure needs very heavy investment. Power utilities don't come cheap, nor do roads, and nor do dams and water supply, or etc. So what has been done has been, a lot has been done on the social side, health, education, etc. Not enough has been done on the infrastructure.
Recently, there were articles in The New Yorker and The New Republic about how there's a rift in al-Qaeda, and that, you know, some people within al-Qaeda are now challenging terrorism and saying that, you know, terrorist acts are not justified by the Quran, except in very, very limited circumstances, that, for instance, the attack on 9/11 doesn't count for, you know, that 9/11 wouldn't be justified under these limited requirements for violence. How major a movement is that within al-Qaeda? How seriously are you taking this dissenting point of view?
Well, you know, my problem with this is, and the advocates of this is, that of course it's a good thing that there should be dissent. But where is this dissent coming from? This dissent is really coming from what I call the old al-Qaeda. That is the pre-9/11 al-Qaeda, or those members of al-Qaeda who were members just after, before and after 9/11. It's not, this dissent is many of these people who are dissenting now have spent time in jail. Many of them have been propped up by governments, for example, the government of Saudi Arabia, the government of Egypt, other Middle East governments are propping up these people to say these things. And it is important. It's a good message to give out. It's a powerful message. It will have some influence. But my qualification is that the new al-Qaeda is really nothing to do with these people. These people do not understand something like the Pakistani Taliban, or even what the Afghan Taliban has become, or what some of these Central Asian groups are today. Al-Qaeda was an organization that in those days stood on a platform on its own. It had allies that were distant allies. Today, Al-Qaeda is meshed in with a huge number of groups, and we really don't know where Al-Qaeda ends and these groups begin. Or we don't know where these groups begin and Al-Qaeda ends. Now, clearly, Al-Qaeda still has a structure. It has leadership. It has they're able to plan and plot. But they're not necessarily carrying out plots themselves. I mean, the suicide bombers in 9/11 were personally vetted by bin Laden. Now, that is not possible today. Bin Laden is not vetting anyone today. He's giving you a vision. He's giving you symbols of attack, you know, such as, for example, the Danish embassy in Islamabad. But his group is so enmeshed with all these other allies now. And many of these allies are coming from very different backgrounds. I mean, the Taliban are basically tribesmen, illiterate, unversed in Quranic studies and Islamic studies. And many of these dissidents that we're talking about belong to a much highly educated Islamic school of thought. I mean, wrong. It was wrong, but they were well-educated. The new Taliban are not well-educated.
So you don't see a whole lot of hope in the few dissenters within al-Qaeda now?
No, I think it's an important part of the anti-al-Qaeda campaign. I'm not diminishing it in any way, but I don't think it's critical. I mean, I don't think these guys have the capacity to halt terrorist attacks, for example.
Right.
I don't think they have the capacity to lead to desertions from Al-Qaeda or from the Taliban or from one of these groups. It's interesting. It's an intellectual kind of debate. It'll be debated certainly in Muslim quarters, in Muslim circles all over the Arab world in particular. Remember, most of these people are Arab, so it's very much an Arab phenomenon, this debate. I wouldn't say it's a phenomenon that's taking place in countries like Indonesia or Pakistan or where there are other large Muslim populations. It's interesting, but it's not going to be critical.
Well, Ahmed Rashid, I want to thank you very much for talking with us, and I wish you safe travels.
Terry, thank you very much.
Ahmed Rashid is a journalist who lives in Pakistan. His new book is called Descent into Chaos, The United States and the Failure of Nation Building in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Central Asia.